Thank you for joining us. Your Family Matters with Carla Dedessi on 1180 WFYL, this and every Friday from 8 until 9. Stream in, tune in around the world. We have Dr. T.O. Moore with us today. He's a principal of the Atlanta Classical Academy, although he's been at Hillsdale. Is that in South Carolina, Dr. Moore?
Hillsdale College?
Yes.
Is in Michigan.
Okay, it's in Michigan. I apologize. He is a former Marine with a Ph.D. from the University of Edinburgh. He served as the founding principal of a top K through 12 classical school in Colorado and advises the Hillsdale Charter School Initiative. Dr. Moore is the author of The Perfect Game and The Story Killers, a common sense case against the Common Core, which I highly recommend we all read right now in the climate of our education. Welcome, Dr. Moore. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
Great. Can you explain to us a little bit about Common Core?
Well, it's hard to get your arms around, but let me offer you my perspective. One of the things that the Common Core does is it's a set of standards, so-called, that have been adopted in 45 states in the country. And at the moment, they're the English standards and the math standards. So we haven't yet seen the history, though we know what it's going to be. We haven't yet seen the science, though we know what it's going to be. But if you take just the English standards, which is what I've looked at before, what they're claiming to do is to replace so-called literary texts with what they call informational texts. And all of this is being done so that we can prepare ourselves, presumably, for this scary thing called the 21st century global economy. And so it has, if you're not grounded in any kind of tradition or great literature, and you hear people saying, oh, well, to prepare our kids for the workplace, they need to read more informational texts and literary texts, this has the ring of plausibility to it. The only thing about it is it's bad both in terms of education, and it's also just out-and-out indoctrination as it's being presented in the schools. So, first of all, what that means is literary texts is just, that's just a phrase. What it really means is great literature. So we're chopping up and getting rid of great literature, like Huckleberry Finn in high school, for example. And we're replacing it with these so-called informational texts that usually can be read in about 5 minutes. And so they fit in with our current compulsion to test on standardized tests.
And they're very boring.
And they're boring. You never would remember anything from one of these texts, really. But a high number of them engage in just outright political propaganda, if not just bad information. So in the Common Core itself, if you look at Appendix B of the documents, you'll find that one of the last documents that they recommend is an article written by someone named Atul Gawande, whom I've never heard of, for The New Yorker in the summer of 2009 called The Cost Conundrum, Healthcare Costs in McAllen, Texas. Well, why were we talking about the cost of healthcare in the summer of 2009? Obviously, it was prepping us for Obamacare.
Yes.
So this is a way to take out Shakespeare and put in recent propaganda on Obamacare. And supposedly this is what's going to make us more prepared for the 21st century global economy.
Which I disagree with.
Right. So all sorts of things like this go on. And I've looked at the textbooks in some detail, and this is what I go into in my book, and I found just really objectionable things, such as instead of reading Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, reading nothing from Mary Shelley herself, except for a small introduction that she wrote to the book Frankenstein, and instead having pictures of monsters, having students dress up like monsters, having them write an autobiography of a monster. And you may ask why we would ever have them do such a silly thing, and it's because too often monster stories are told from the monster's point of view, or told from the human point of view, and so we need the monster's point of view.
Right.
And then to top it off, we have a dialogue from Saturday Night Live in which there's this mock dialogue of Frankenstein. And the way that it ends, what happens is Frankenstein's monster shows up at the village, and everybody, the villagers, start blaming each other and claiming that each other are the monster. And one villager points to another and says, I think you're the monster. And that one villager says, I'm not the monster. Look at him, pointing to Frankenstein's monster. He has green skin, at which point Frankenstein's monster says, oh, so now it's a racial thing. You know what? You guys are a bunch of fascists. And
so
then
again,
in the
propaganda.
Margin, to make it worse, in the margin of the teacher's edition, so this is what the teacher would use to instruct the children, it says, point out the use of the term fascist, explain its traditional meaning, and the way that it has been applied now to refer to all right-wing extremist groups.
So they're targeting, right. I've read the same things that you are. I've watched the little blurbs that talk about the history that says that Reagan did not bring down communism, but it was actually Gorbachev that brought down communism, which is just a lie. I'm also seeing this math that is so utterly ridiculous, this lattice math that they're teaching our children instead of just lining things up in the ones column, the 10 column. You know, just a little bit about my background. I do a classical approach. We're involved with classical conversations here in Pennsylvania. However, we felt led that we wanted to eventually mainstream our daughter. So I did put Vittoria in my oldest a couple of years ago. And really, we're there because we just feel led that we want to be a light in the public school. We, thankfully, are in an excellent public school, but you know, I am constantly down there. My husband's constantly down there. And, you know, we're just going to have to evaluate year to year whether we keep her there. But she came home, Dr. Moore, a month ago with a Common Core, because Pennsylvania we have gone over, a Common Core writing assignment. And in it, it said, this is the definition of heroes. And she said, Mom, I already talked to my teacher about it, and she knows that I disagree. And the new definition of heroes was anyone who accomplishes their dreams. So immediately, Dr. Moore, I said, did you ask her if Hitler, why isn't Hitler on this list? And why isn't the Boston Bombers on this list? And I'll tell you, Dr. Moore, I was not impressed with who was on this list. There were 25 basketball players and football players, Tim Tebow not being one of them. Lady Gaga was on this list. Of course, all you can do is laugh, otherwise you'd cry. So, of course, I wrote a letter to the teacher immediately and said, listen, my daughter's really not interested in doing any reports on the heroes that you've given to her. We would like to do Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Tim Tebow, Ben Carson. And she was kind. She said, absolutely. She can do, you know, anything that she chooses. I think that they're good choices. But I said to her, and my husband went in and actually talked to the principal, and we said, listen, you're trying to promote drug-free zones in your schools and anti-violence. Why do you have somebody like Allen Iverson, who's a professional, I don't think he's a professional basketball player anymore, but he was incarcerated multiple times, Dr. Moore, for drug possession and assault. Why is he on the list as a hero? And why is Lady Gaga there? We're trying to promote modesty. We have a dress code in our school. Really? Lady Gaga's on there? Now, in their defense, it had to be someone in the last 100 years. But again, we can absolutely pick better heroes than that. But I believe that's what Common Core is bringing into our schools.
Well, so first of all, you know, the way that this has been set up is a travesty. The study of heroism is a part of education, and it should be. But anybody who knows anything about education knows that the great heroes they're not only from the past, but the models of great heroes are from the past. And unless we know how great men and women have acted in the past, we don't have any way of evaluating who a true hero is nowadays. And that's why you have this alphabet soup of all these people who are nothing but folks from the popular culture. Whereas in the past, the founding fathers grew up reading Plutarch's Lives of the noble Grecians and Romans. And so you knew who the great heroes were. You knew who... You knew who Cincinnatus was, who was this great Roman general who, after he had saved the Republic, he then returned to his farm. So that when George Washington retired from his position as general, when everybody in Europe thought that he would just remain a dictator, he did exactly what Cincinnatus would have done. And people looked at George Washington as a Cincinnatus. And so when you have those models, then you teach young people the kind of way that they should behave in their own lives, whereas if you just say, realizing your dreams in this kind of ulti, false egalitarian idea of heroism, then anybody who's a part of the popular culture then is a hero. And of course, what these students need is the exact opposite of that. They need true heroes to speak to their soul, and not the claptrap that they get in the contemporary culture.
Right, and they believe that across all categories, whether it's art, whether it's music, we should be identifying them with Beethoven and, you know, the Renaissance, not with this new information, because as you said, we need to hold a very high standard up to them, whether it's George Washington or the like. And I think that your book talks a little bit about that we're actually, you know, killing imaginations and killing the stories of our children because we're really not teaching them the good stories, right?
Right. Well, see, the great stories teach you the English language.
Yes.
They teach you aspects of the human condition, both good and bad, but they also bring out the beautiful things in life that inspire you and that want you make you want to be good. And so, on the one hand, you think, okay, well, we're giving up a few literary texts so we can have more informational texts. It's the modern world. What's the big deal? If you talk about killing a child's imagination, if you talk about killing off his soul, or at least failing to feed it, then that's a big deal. And that's exactly what's going on. And you can tell that it's going on because not just the humanities, but the arts are dying a slow death in our schools.
Yes.
Music is increasingly not being taught. Art has almost been done away with. So what will these children have to think beauty is other than the kind of nonsense that they get in the popular culture, which, frankly, does not lead to happiness, and it sets up a very jaded view of the world. Is if you live your life according to the dictates of the lyrics of a Lady Gaga song, you're not going to end up happy at age 35. I guarantee you.
No, you may end up dead.
Precisely.
Right, committing suicide, being very or in rehab. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit also about the fiscal impact. What do you think is going to happen with this Common Core if it's implemented across all of our states?
Well, it will cost money. Of course, this is all fake money. It's not fake money, but it's all. I think a big shell game, frankly. Because what happens is, anytime you have one of these regimens come in where they say we have to teach to the Common Core, then everybody goes ballistic and says, okay, well, we have to have all this new training, we have to have new textbooks, and people are making billions off the Common Core. There's an entire computer industry being created off Common Core testing.
Right.
It's probably no surprise that Bill Gates' money is what funded this initially. And the textbook industries are just growing rich off of it because you will constantly have to update your textbooks to be core knowledge or Common Core compatible. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, if you think about it, how much money does it really take to educate a child? If you've been involved with classical conversations, you know that it's not much.
It's not much. And our kids are doing 15% better on all of their standardized tests, the homeschoolers.
Well, it's not just that. A copy of Moby Dick you can get for $5.
Yes.
And that can keep students, that can keep a classroom of students, let's say 20 students, $100 is your outlay for books. That can keep them occupied for the better part of a semester. And they will come out of it not just knowing a story about a whale, but they'll know a lot more about the English language and a lot more about the human condition. Whereas these giant textbooks in which they will put, and I've seen them, they put the first chapter and the last chapter of Moby Dick, not even the first chapter. That's it. And then in there with all this other stuff to include all these informational texts, that textbook will cost you $150. Not to mention all the software and stuff that backs it up and the TV station that the teachers are going to tune into so that they know how to teach the lessons. So this is just ridiculous. All this is being spent, or rather wasted, on something that has really marginal returns and actually dumbs down learning beyond what it is already, which is not good.
And I agree with you that our founding fathers, who were all great heroes and men and very brilliant, you know, they didn't have these fancy schmancy curriculums that we have. And yet they, you know, Benjamin Franklin just emulated the greats. He said that he would read a book, a classic, and then he would just try to imitate that writing. And I think that you're right. These big companies like GE, Microsoft, Google, InBloom, ExxonMobil evidently has their hand in this. Pearson Publishing, they all have something to gain. It's all monetary. And I think that that's also one of the red flags for me as a mom, is that it's these big corporations that are creating the curriculum. It's not teachers. It's not parents. It's not school boards.
Right. And it's not anybody who really cares about learning.
No.
So,
and they don't care about our children. They're just propagating.
Right. I've had to spend a lot of time with these textbooks, and I've had to listen to people as I've gone around the country defend the Common Core, to include state superintendents of education. And they never use learning to defend it. I've never run into a school superintendent who has quoted Shakespeare or Winston Churchill. What they do instead is give you all this claptrap about a globally competitive society and more diversity, and it's all these different loaded terms, all of which are just simply selling out education in the name of something that they can't even define. And it's just, these are catchphrases which embrace this new world, and yet this new world apparently is just one of total ignorance and a removal from any lessons from the past.
Dr. Moore, are you familiar with, in 2006, the Moscow Declaration that was signed between our Secretary of State and Russia? And this all happened at the UN, and evidently in this Moscow Declaration, that's exactly what it said, is that we want to move towards a global education.
Right, and Right.
Well, we shouldn't.
There are things to learn from other countries, and if we wanted to learn things from Russia, I think what we do is we pick up a copy of Dostoevsky and read Crime and Punishment. So there's certainly things to be learned from other cultures, but this pan-globalism that's creeping into the school now is just, it's the sharing of mutual ignorance on the one hand, and then on the other hand, this kind of amorphous global community that's supposed to solve all our problems, which nobody can really even define. Whereas in this country, we have institutions, we have a constitution, we have a free market, we're on the way towards not having a free market, but we have free markets and free people and free institutions and things that are American, that America used to export to other countries that other countries wanted, because they're true and because they work. So why aren't we talking in that way? That was the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan. Why aren't we talking in that way rather than just kind of lumping ourselves in with this global society that we can't even define or know what its purpose is?
I mean, who knows the answer to that? I feel like, we do not have the hearts and minds of the mainstream media who for some reason are anti-America and just want to go global. And, I don't think that that's ever worked in the past when anyone ever tries to come together. And what we've done here in the United States of America has worked so well with Reaganomics and, the Founding Fathers' education once upon a time. And once upon a time, what Yale and Harvard and Princeton were teaching to our kids was so rich. So it is a little fearful that we're moving away from that. I'll tell you that here in the state of Pennsylvania, we do have groups coming together at the grassroots. We have Pennsylvania's Against Common Core, Catholics Against Common Core, but it's really hard, Dr. Moore, because all of our school systems and superintendents and the teachers, it's almost like they've been brainwashed. Like, here, put this in. Our state got $42 million to institute this. We took $42 million to do this. So if we...
Which is a drop in the bucket, by the way, compared to a state.
Well, and I also think that it's a drop in the bucket compared to what it, when we do institute all of this and there's no more money coming in, I think it's really going to cost us a lot, taxpayers now.
Right.
They're going to tax us. Someone's going to have to keep this up. So.
Well, one thing that you say is very interesting, which is you find these different groups who are fighting it. But this Common Core, which is meant to extinguish, I think, all the different forms of school choice, particularly those that are moving in a classical direction that we were seeing and that we continue to see, in order to stamp out, and this is the funny part, in order to stamp out choice, which really is stamping out diversity. What we've been seeing out of classical charter schools, out of the homeschooling movement, out of certain startup classical private schools, and just in all these different things, is that returning to tradition is actually what causes students to learn and to prepare them better for college and to prepare them better for life. And at the very moment where we can see the results of that, in comes the Common Core, which is taking over all the public schools,
mm-hmm.
which is essentially taking over the entire Catholic school system,
mm-hmm.
which threatens homeschoolers because of the standardized testing that's going to accompany it to include the SAT. And so this is a movement towards the end of school choice, more so than anything that we've ever seen. These last, you know, the Goals 2000 and those things that were tried back in the 90s with Clinton were nothing compared to the Common Core in terms of the scope and reach.
Which is so un-American not to have choices. You know, I don't know if you have the answer to this question, but I use Singapore math with my little girls. And when I ordered my textbooks this last year, 2013, 2014, they were stamped with Common Core approval on them. Now, my understanding is that Singapore math, like, why are they getting their hands into that, Dr. Moore?
I don't know. And the schools that I work with do use Singapore math. I think there is a little bit of the, if you're a textbook out there and you know that your livelihood depends on selling books to schools that are forced to use the Common Core, if you don't have that logo, you're sunk.
Maybe that, yeah.
Publishing company. So one hopes that they've just slapped it on the logo and haven't changed the substance.
Right, because I still think that it's very challenging. So I was just curious if you, but that certainly makes sense because sometimes it's about the bottom line for a lot of these companies. So Dr. Moore, where can we get the story Killers, A Common Sense Case Against the Common Core? Because I think that we all need to read this as parents.
Sure, you can get that on Amazon or you can just download it straight onto your Kindle.
Okay, so awesome. I have three little girls, and when we go on summer vacation, I like to, instead of bringing along 50 books, you know, just bring along the Kindle that has 150 books on there.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for giving us time this morning and educating us on a classical education and how fabulous that is, and now what we have to look forward to with Common Core. And I thank you for starting all these awesome schools, which are creating wonderful leaders for our future country.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Take care. Do well out there in Georgia.
All right.
Okay, bye. This is Your Family Matters with Carla Dedesi, 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty. I am here in the studio with Mr. Joe Wisenick. He is a top lawyer in Mainline Today magazine, an awesome attorney in the Suburban Life Mainline magazine, Philadelphia's top-rated lawyers, as published in the Philadelphia Inquirer. He served a term as president of the Honorable John E. Stively, Junior American Inn of Court, which is the teaching arm of the Chester County Bar Association for young lawyers aspiring to be trial attorneys, which we talked a little bit about just a couple minutes ago, right, Joe?
Yes, Carla.
And I think what I love most about you, because this is a show where we talk about families, is the fact that you've been married for how many years?
46.
46 years. I love it. And you have 6 or 7 beautiful daughters?
We're blessed with 7 girls.
7 beautiful girls. I feel like such a slacker because I have 3 little girls. I hope my husband's listening. Maybe we can have some more. He's going to kill me, Joe. Okay. So really, I'm quite honored to have you here with me. And besides being a wonderful husband and a wonderful father, do you have grandchildren?
We have one grandson down in Florida, Mateo Joseph. He'll be 2 in August.
Wonderful place to visit, I'm sure.
It is.
And I also, we are going to talk a lot about your involvement with the pro-life movement and the right to life. And that is so exciting to me because, you know, science tells us now, back in the 70s, we did not have science to tell us that at 3 weeks there's a heart beating, right, inside of that mommy.
That's correct.
But now we have all of this science, and it shares with us that the baby inside of the mother does indeed feel pain. and it actually tries to move away from the instruments that are coming in to do harm that the abortion doctor's bringing in. Did you ever see the silent scream that Ronald Reagan showed to his cabinet?
Yes, I saw the silent scream and then the Eclipse of Reason, both produced by Dr. Bernard Nathanson, now deceased, who was the foremost abortionist in America, who did a complete turnaround and joined the pro-life movement.
That's right. I think that when a lot of people do get educated that this is a life that is feeling pain and we are stopping a heartbeat, which really means death, I mean something is dying, then I'm not really sure how you can still vote pro-abortion candidates in. And I think that many of us are very concerned about saving trees, and I think that we need to be more concerned about saving babies and also saving mothers, because really I believe that Planned Parenthood has really taken mommies and taken them in a very vulnerable state and used it against them to say things like, it's really not a baby that you're carrying, it doesn't resemble a baby, you know, it's just a scab inside of you or fetal tissue. This is how they talk, right?
Correct. Products of conception.
Yes.
We have a need for a strong economy, a strong national defense, a good educational system, a healthcare system. But if you're not preserving the most basic right, that is the right to life, what's the use of all these other issues that people identify with and vote on the basis of purely their pocketbooks? We're going to pay a price someday for over 50 million abortions in this nation. And I agree with you, the mother is victimized too by the abortion industry. And I know the pro-life movement has been has increased its membership with women that have had the abortions. And Olivia Gons formed the Woman Exploited by Abortion. The first year she had 10,000 members. Doesn't get reported in the newspapers or in the media for the most part.
Let me start back in 1971 when you shared with me that you were living in Chicago, Illinois, and this is when you were first introduced to the pro-life movement. Can we go back there? Can you give us why this has inspired you and you've given 40-plus years to this movement?
Well, I saw a slide presentation in the basement of the church in Chicago produced by Dr. Jack Wilkie and Mrs. Wilkie. He was a physician. She was a nurse. And I just saw the actual graphic pictures of what abortion really is and how well-formed these babies are in trash bins and trash bags. And it sunk in for a couple of days. And then maybe it was Providence, but I saw an ad at the law school on the bulletin board for a pro-life attorney wanted someone to do some research on the Fairness Doctrine. And the Fairness Doctrine was that you're supposed to have something like equal time on controversial issues. And I did some research for attorney Larry Patterson, and that's when I got involved with the Illinois Right to Life movement. And when we came back to Pennsylvania, I got in the pro-life movement right away. But the pictures of those children, unborn children, haunted me. And I figured I had to, you know, contribute in some way. And as it worked out, I became a legal representative of many of the direct action, nonviolent, prayerful protesters who blocked doors and tried to counsel women at the last moment before they went into the abortion chambers. And so that's how I got involved in the movement.
And then let's go forward now a few years, because 1971, let's go back again. I just said we're going forward, but now we're going to rewind. But in 1971 is really when Roe versus Wade was one, and so now we have abortion that's legal, and so now we need to really start educating the masses. 1973, thank you for correcting me. So let's talk a little bit about the National Lawyers Association. Can you tell us who makes this up?
Okay, the American Bar Association, of which I was a member at one time, in the, I forget what year it was, but it was in the summer, they had their convention. And a group of lawyers that were pro-abortion put through a proposition that was adopted as one of the principles of the ABA to support Roe v. Wade, abortion on demand, and caught the pro-life members off guard. Many of us withdrew from the ABA and formed the NLA, the National Lawyers Association, of which I had the privilege of serving as a board member, and they are based in Denver, Colorado. They meet in Chicago, and we're trying to give the possibility of joining another professional association, such as the NLA, that you can live with their principles. Now they're dealing with other issues too, such as religious freedom, mm-hmm. and the attacks on religious freedom, mm-hmm. And so forth.
That's right. And actually, let's talk about the attacks on religious freedom a little bit. I've never seen an administration that is attacking religious freedoms like this one is. Would you agree that this, we're at a war when I think of Hobby Lobby, and I think of Chick-fil-A, and I think of Wheaton College, and I think of all of the Catholic universities that have to go up and spend their time and their money to say that we do not want to give the abortion pill, right?
Right. They've made an accommodation that let's say a Catholic university can buy health insurance and pay for the premiums, of course, for their employees, but not have to afford, you know, at least for the time being, pay for abortions. But what happens is it's a shell game. That's what I would call it, because the employee can go talk to Independence Blue Cross Blue Shield and arrange to have that without going through the university that bought the group health plan for their faculty and for their administrators. So it's people are being made indirectly being made to pay for abortion.
That's right, and I disagree with that wholeheartedly. Let me ask you this as a lawyer. Let's say there's Methodist Hospital in South Philadelphia, or St. Agnes. It's a Methodist hospital, and it is a Catholic hospital, okay? Now, if I have issues with Methodists or with Catholics, I can choose to work somewhere else, correct?
Yes.
So why are we giving these people of religion issues and problems? Why are the secularists trying to force us to swallow their pills?
That's a good question. Just to assert their muscle, and as I say, tax on a religious freedom. And we used to be able to mention God in schools, and now there's been a recent decision where we can at public meetings open with a prayer.
Yes.
A big concession, right?
Right, exactly. And we used to start all of our meetings with prayers. As you know, the Founding Fathers used to pray before all of their meetings in the Constitution, and even still in Harrisburg, they pray before they start, even though people are up in arms about that. But so my point is that we are not, as religious institutions, whether it's an adoption agency, whether it is a university, whether it is a church, we are not infringing on anyone's constitutional rights if we say up front, this is what we believe, and you can come here and abide by that or go and get a job somewhere else. We're not stepping on anyone's constitutional rights.
I agree with that.
Okay. So let's move on. So if I am a lawyer and I want to get involved with the NLA because I am pro-life, I would just look that up on the internet.
Right. Or,
okay.
Or you could call our firm and I'd give you the information.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the future of our culture, where we're really making a decision to choose death versus life.
It's interesting that when our president, President Obama, was a member of the legislature, there was a bill that came down before them indicating that if the baby survives the abortion procedure, you cannot deny medical treatment for the baby. And he voted against that. And I know when he spoke at Notre Dame, when he was honored at Notre Dame, and he spoke there, he was very conciliatory in talking about keeping abortion, you know, safe and legal and as infrequent as possible. He gave the crowd what they wanted to hear. But when you think about that position about denying medical treatment for a baby that survives the abortion procedure, and we all know about the horrors of Dr. Gosnell in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Where was the mayor of Philadelphia and the governor of Pennsylvania when that was going on? A lot of these politicians pay homage to the abortion movement. They get funding from them. Mayor Rendell called Kate Michelman a saint, going to canonize her. Many of these... You mentioned the Catholic Church. Many of the politicians that are Catholic, such as John Kerry, the late Edward Kennedy, Christopher Dodd, the Vice President Joseph Biden, Patrick Leahy from Vermont, all vote straight abortion every time. You know, they sort of forget where they came from. And I think then you have champions in the pro-life movement like Rick Santorum.
Yes.
And I hope he makes a run for president.
I hope you're right.
And I think the country's ready for that. I know the press will savage him, but he's a strong person, a good family man. He's highly intelligent. He finished second to Romney last time. And I hope Rick's what we need, I think, to try to reverse some of these trends of the culture of death. The culture of life, I think, is young. Even some of the higher-ups at Planned Parenthood admit that their movement's getting grayer. And they look at all these college and high school students among the 300,000 in Washington at the March for Life.
Mm-hmm.
It's very encouraging. There are more crisis pregnancy centers now than abortion chambers in America. It's been that way for a while. I had the privilege to serve as president of Birthright of Westchester when it was initially formed. So we have to give the pregnant woman alternatives and support, and the men have to take on their responsibility too and not abandon the woman. That's, you know, and I think
that's
we
right.
have a society will help this situation do with these women that are looking for help and giving them alternatives to abortion. Ultrasound, when they see the ultrasound at the pro-life counseling centers, they usually don't go through with the procedure. And I've been in court defending, let's say, Michael McMonagle in Operation Rescue, and I had a woman come in labor, a minority woman in labor. She says, I want to testify for Mr. McMonagle in federal court because he came and he took me into his home with his family, and I'm having my baby now and gave me support. And I owe him a lot. I don't want to see him punished by the court. So I think we're gaining. There are less abortions. I think it's a key issue. And I think we are going to become a culture of life and not a culture of death.
Mm-hmm. And I think that perhaps there's so much violence in our schools and in our culture as a whole, because it ties right back to devaluing life inside of the womb. I really do. I believe there's a direct connection in that. Can you tell us a little bit about, I'm excited to hear about some of the cases where you have protected the women who are pro-life. You talked a little bit about that. Is there something that really sticks out in your mind?
Well, the first case I got involved with were I represented Joan Andrews and her sister Miriam Andrews, and they were the first pioneers of the rescue movement. It was peaceful, nonviolent. They stood at the abortion chamber doors at the Crozier Abortion Center on the grounds and campus of Crozier Chester Hospital in Delaware County, and they locked arms in the doors and they refused to move, and they had some pro-life literature. And so they were charged with conspiracy to commit defiant criminal trespass. And another attorney and I, Jack Breen was his name, we represented Joan and Miriam, and we went out to scout the campus out there to see where they were standing and where the doors were and the guards and everything. And it was ironic. It was just before Christmas when we went out there. It was a slight snow flurry, and they had chimes on the campus playing Christmas music. And the building that was now the abortuary was the building where Martin Luther King studied to become a minister. And you can still see the stained glass cross on the top of the building above the door. And as the chimes played Silent Night, Holy Infant So Tender and Mild, we saw mothers walking into the abortion chamber to have abortions. And we tried that case. The judge would not let us use the justification defense because the Roe v. Wade said abortion is legal on all 9 months, by the way. People don't know that. But in certain situations, they can be aborted at the very end of the pregnancy.
I didn't know that. So back in 1973.
I'll get back to that in a second, Carla. But we couldn't use the justification defense. But the jury came in on a technicality. They acquitted the Andrews sisters. And in my closing, I pointed to the prosecutor's counsel table and I said, see all the books they have there and all the books we have at our table, the books on evidence and the statute and the criminal code. I said, there's one book that's the most important book. It's the book everyone put their hand on when they testified in this case. And in that book, it says in Jeremiah, before you were born, I formed you in the womb, and I consecrated you. And that's and the jury came back and acquitted the Andrews sisters, and that was the first case I was involved in. I was involved in other cases as well. Then they passed that FACE bill, which is a draconian bill, $100,000 fines and imprisonment for lengthy periods of time for blocking access to the clinic doors.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so that sort of discouraged any kind of direct action. But I think we need the crisis pregnancy centers. Direct action served its purpose. It drew more attention. It was civil disobedience, nonviolent. But I think education is the biggest factor. If you can educate the young and show them the biology of the unborn and that they are sentient beings, they can feel pain, and the mothers have been scarred. When George Herbert Walker Bush debated Dukakis in the presidential debates, he was caught off guard when they said, would you force the criminal code against the mother and the abortionist? And he said, well, I guess you have to follow the law. But the law never punished the mother, the expectant mother. She was always considered to be a victim, along with her child, a victim of the abortionist.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we've had physicians that were abortionists have now come over to the pro-life side. And so I think there's great optimism in the pro-life movement. Well, the media is not on our side, but the truth is.
That's right. The media is not on our side, but the truth indeed is. And you talked a little bit about we do need to raise up little future pro-lifers. And I recently felt called to write a book called Julia Learns How to Vote Wisely. And my youngest is Julia. I have three little girls. And in that book, I teach my daughters, but it's also on Amazon and, you know, Barnes & Noble's, it's everywhere. But I teach my children that we must get involved civically. And one of the first reasons that we look for a good candidate is the candidate who protects babies while they're in the mommy's womb. This is not a Democrat or Republican book. It is a book that is rearing children, little ones, to be sensitive to life inside of the mother.
You know, out of the voices of little ones come the truth. When you talk about your youngest daughter and the book you're writing, I think there was an author, Jean Garten, I think she was a member of the Lutheran Church, and she was looking at the Wilkie slides one night, and her daughters were asleep. But one daughter awoke and came down the steps, and she watched this. She wouldn't show her daughter this, but she watched it unbeknownst to Jean Garten.
Right.
And the little girl said, "Mommy, who broke the baby?"
Mm.
So there's, you know, we have politicians with multiple degrees and years of experience vote pro-abortion all the time, and this little innocent child knew that there was something wrong, that they broke the baby, and knew it was a baby.
That's right. So I think that it's too late to start teaching our children about this when they're 14 or 15. I believe that we need to plant seeds, that we value all life, no matter how small, right at conception, and we just need to be planting those seeds when they're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. And not one book existed on this. That's why I felt called to write that book. Are you familiar with Susan B. Anthony List?
I know they're pro-life.
Right. They're a large, you would really love them. They are in Washington, D.C. Marjorie Dannensfelder is their executive director. 20 years ago, she started this pro-life movement in her garage. And they basically back legislatures and lawmakers, primarily try to get women who are pro-life, and we fundraise and give them money to get pro-life women. We will also get pro-life men in so that we can actually change the laws. And they've been quite effective, and they're growing. But they called me and said, we would like to use 700 of your books at our March event to give out to all of our guests. So that was a real honor for me and for my little book. But I wanted to share also that Susan B. Anthony has watched a bill be passed, beginning in Texas, I believe. It's the No Pain Bill, where you're not allowed to have an abortion after 20 weeks, because indeed science shows pain there. So it sounds silly because we're saying, yay, this is a victory that you can't have an abortion after 20 weeks, but indeed it's actually saving something like 400 lives a day in the state of Texas. And I think about 5 or 6 states have adopted that now.
You know, you mentioned that I think there are some bills in certain states concerning the humane slaughter of cattle at the slaughterhouses that have more protection than we have for our unborn children.
That's right. It's backwards. There's some whales that have more protection in Alaska than our children have in the womb.
And you talked about trees. There was the case, Justice Douglas, now deceased, said the California redwood tree should have legal standing as persons to protect the trees, but he also voted against capital punishment, Fulton v. Georgia. Yet when it comes to the unborn, he voted for Roe v. Wade, which allows, if there's three trimesters, in the third trimester, it has restrictions on abortion, but if the life or health of the mother is at issue, then you can have the abortion in the final trimester. And they define health with a very World Health Organization loose definition to encompass psychological, familial, economic, you know, well-being. So mm-hmm. we know doctors like Gosnell can always sign a form saying that it's going to affect her psychologically and so forth. You can have the abortion for the entire 9 months. They create the image that it's only the first trimester,
mm-hmm.
but it's the whole 9 months.
That's right. And I want to also bring to our listeners' attention that Planned Parenthood is a $1 billion business with a B. And aren't they also getting subsidized by our government as well?
Millions. And another thing is they say they play down their, they use the word services or providers to candy coat what abortion is. It's always in the context of abortion provider or abortion services. But they say that they do pap smears and they do blood tests and education and birth control and all this. And they talk about that only a certain percentage of their work is abortion, their procedures. But when you look at the dollars they get, overwhelmingly,
right.
that without abortion, they'd be bankrupt.
Right.
And I'd love to see it happen. I'd love to see them go bankrupt.
I would love to see them go bankrupt,
and once again, the politicians are using our money, directly or indirectly, to fund Planned Parenthood.
And you talked a little bit about some of our Catholic or religious leaders who go to church on Sunday, but they're voting pro-abortion on Monday. And when I look at these people, I truly have to say, I think that the almighty dollar is their God versus God.
Holding office.
Right. Or holding office is more important. That's right.
We need more statesmen than politicians. And that's why I cited, you know, Rick Santorum as a perfect example of a good family man, a courageous guy who's been taking a beating in the media. And you know, and my daughter had been on his staff for 2 years in Washington. She just ran into him out at the presidential library in California for Ronald Reagan. And he has a production company now.
That's right, Echo Lights.
Right.
And they're producing good family movies.
If the theaters show them. You know,
that's right, exactly. Well, you know, he had a movie out in December called Christmas Candle, and I think it did well, and it's coming out on DVD this Christmas, 2014. And he has another movie that's going to be on the Hallmark Channel as well. And I had the opportunity to speak with him recently about his book, Blue Collar Conservatives. I think he has a lot of great ideas in that book. If you haven't picked it up, you should.
Just like the Reagan Democrats.
Right. Right, right, with Reaganomics. So I think that he's, of course, the media is not going to be on his side because I believe that Santorum stands for truth and that he's not going to be swayed and that he's a man of conviction. But I do pray that he gets into the White House. I think that he would really bring this country in the direction that it needs to go. So is there anything else that you would like to share with me today that to leave in our listeners' ear about, you know, the sanctity of life, protecting life?
You know, if you lose respect for any part of life, you lose respect for all of life. And I think when you have a nation that has abortion on demand, mm-hmm. I think child abuse increases after the babies are born.
I agree.
You know, and you can't lose respect for any part of life. You have to respect all of life. And I think it's great that this station exists and part of the Fox-affiliated networks and so forth to get the truth out.
Yes.
Because I think the major media filters everything. But even I noticed some trends recently, and my wife Kathy's pointed this out to me, that some of the liberals are now becoming a little more conservative. They've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And what's next in our society? What's the next movement? And,
right.
And you know, we were a great nation. We respected, powerful nation, a just nation. Sure, we had some moments where we made mistakes, but overall.
Sure.
Overall, we are a just nation. When you see these other nations where they're stoning women because they're married a Christian, letting her, and you know, pregnant women being stoned to death.
Right.
The Sudan, the genocide in the Sudan. It's the classic struggle, good versus evil.
That's
you know?
Right.
And I think we're We're going to prevail. We know that.
Yes, yes, we do know that good wins in the end, even if we have to be dragged through the muck and mire. Thank you so much for being with us. Right before I let you go, have you read Ronald Reagan's book, Abortion and the Conscience of a Nation? That's a really good one.
It's a short book, too.
It is a short book, yeah. Which makes it even better.
I read it. I did read it.
Yes, that's really quite good. I'd like to turn that into a children's book, actually.
And who's it? Peggy Noonan wrote a book, When Character Mattered.
Okay.
And that was about the Reagan administration.
Okay. So I think that we've given our listeners so much to digest and think about. I want to thank Mr. Sam Wasinek for being in the studio with us today. He is a fabulous lawyer. He has been in many mainline magazines, Philadelphia magazines. You've been in practice for how many years?
Since 1974.
Okay, and we can find you on a website?
WasinekBrogan.com.
Okay, and how many lawyers do you have working with you?
We have five.
Five,
counting myself.
Okay, awesome. So these are lawyers that you can trust. You know why? Because they understand that all life is valuable. And all life is equal, whether it's one day old or 101 years old, it is all valuable, and it has been designed by a purposeful creator. So this is Your Family Matters, 1180 WFYL. We are here every Friday from 8 until 9, and I hope that you enjoyed our show and that you will join us next Friday.